Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
And in turn, my pleasure to introduce the second of the Hitchcock lectures by Professor Chikashi Toyoshima from the University of Tokyo. Toyoshima's group published the first structure of the calcium ATPase in 2000. It's a large and unwieldy membrane protein, and determining the first structures were both a conceptual and technical tour de force. His group has subsequently determined structures of the pump in many stages of the handling of calcium and ATP, and from those structures, Toyoshima has been able to visualize, for the first time in any system, a process of active transport. That's what he showed us briefly at the end of yesterday's lecture and will tell us about in depth today. Please join me in welcoming him.
So today I'd like to tell you about the calcium pump in much more detail. So just for summarizing yesterday's lecture, So this is a kind of design consideration, the calcium ATPase, calcium pump. And so it's an ATP power pump, and it has a very high efficiency of energy usage, and specific to calcium. And so that means it must have a mechanism for rejecting, for example, sodium ions. And it must have at least two gates, and cytoplasmic and luminal gates. In the transmembrane region. And a mechanism, it must have a mechanism that correlates the chemical reaction that takes place in the cytoplasmic region to a gating of the transmembrane ion pathway. And I show you the chemical reaction occurs here, and the actual binding site is located here, and the gating occurs here and there. And there must be a mechanism to correlate that kind of reaction, small reaction, chemical reaction to ion pathway gating. So it's a very long distance transmission of intramolecular transmission of signal. It's about 50 angstrom away. And so I have to sort of explain the terminology of today's talk. Essentially, we say the active transport is organized, achieved by two conformations of this enzyme. So the E1 form, it has high affinity to calcium, and E2 form, it has a low affinity to calcium. So the basic idea is that you have to sort of catch the calcium in the cytoplasm, and then it sort of occludes these bound calcium ions, and then open another gate here. It's called luminal gate, and by changing the affinity to calcium to a very low one, low affinity, it releases the calcium. So the basic idea is the change of affinity of transmembrane binding site from high affinity to low affinity, then release it with the enzyme sort of achieves active transport. And during the reaction cycle, the gamma phosphate of ATP actually transfers first to enzyme itself. So it is a phosphorylated state. So refers to a phosphorylated state, we use the term P state. So the E1P state means it has high affinity to calcium and it's phosphorylated, right? And all that happens, the phosphorylation also takes place in the E2 state, and only this, please remember that only this state, the luminal gate is open. Okay. To sort of understand this kind of mechanism in detail, we have to sort of crystallize the structures. the key of the crystallization is you have to sort of fix the protein in one conformation. And in this case, the calcium, so in a way, you need the inhibitors. And in this case, the calcium itself works as inhibitors. And here, we use the ATP analog, AMP-PCP. And as a phosphorylation, that's the phosphorylation state, we have aluminum fluoride, magnesium fluoride, and beryl fluoride. Those fluorine complexes act as a good phosphate analog. That work was actually done in this campus area. And so to stabilize E2 form, so in this case, nothing really stabilize it in the native form, then I have to add some inhibitors. The most famous one, Tapsigargin, or butylhydroquinone, or cyclopiasonic acid, or something like that. And so far, we got these crystals at relatively high resolution as for the membrane proteins. And the best one is 2.1 angstrom resolution. And all of them, I can sort of reach all the state, I can tell you the structures better than 3 angstrom resolution. Another point I should make is to make these crystals, I have to add a lipid so that to mimic the native environment. So the crystal actually like this. So it's stacks of two-dimensional crystals. And I showed this picture yesterday. And so this is a sort of electron microscopy picture of a cross-section of one of the crystal. And so you see the in the magnified view, you see the lipid barriers going up, going like this, and make sort of loops. And even this area, you see very funny lipid loops sticking out from the crystalline layers. So it is clear that we have crystals in which the ATP is in a lipid-like environment. And so this is a sort of status of February. So at least when I started the project, I could imagine that we may be able to get 8 crystals of different stages. And so far, we have succeeded in 7 of them. And we don't have this one, so-called E1P state structures, but we know that these 3 are very much the same from a limited proteolysis study, and we can say that there is no big domain movement. So mostly I use this one for representing this one. So this one is aluminum fluoride bound form, and so it's a transition state analog. And ADP is still bound. And the most recent addition is this one. And I hope you remember that only in this state the luminal gate is open. And other state, the luminal gate are closed. And so from these 7 crystal structures, by generating the intermediate structures, by simple interpolation, we could make this kind of movies. So the calcium now get into the binding site, and the ATP comes in, and phosphorylation takes place, and the calcium get out, and that kind of things. Of course, it's too quick, and even I cannot explain you in time. So I'd like to tell you the sort of mechanism step by step. But and also, this kind of movie is not perfect one, and because we generate intermediate states by simple interpolation. There's something funny things you can perhaps see. But from these, we can address important question, and the movement we saw so large and complicated. Why such a large and complicated movements are necessary? And what does ATP do and what does phosphorylation do? We can address these kind of questions. Well, so, and this is the sort of first structure we got in year 2000. And so this is the calcium-bound form. And I showed this yesterday. And so this is a transmembrane region. It consists of 10 transmembrane helices. And if you look at the cytoplasmic regions, it consists of three well-separated domains. And this one is at the center is called phosphorylation domain, so it's P domain. And because this phosphorylation residue, in this case, is actually aspartate. So it's a kind of a bacterial type phosphorylations. This domain locates here. And N domain is called so because the adenine moiety of ATP binds here. And A domain was sort of very ambiguous domain at the beginning, but it turned out to be a kind of actuator of a transmembrane gating mechanism. So I made a perhaps right correction naming, and so this is A domain. So calcium, as you see here, it's located side by side, although we know that calcium binding is strictly sequential. And also, I would like to stress that the A domain has a sort of three links. All of them look like flexible links to the transmembrane regions. To make you familiar, well, is it possible to write down? But perhaps not. Well, it's difficult to see, perhaps. And so this is a cytoplasmic region, and this one is a N domain. Nucleotide binding domain, and this central one is the P domains, is the yellow ones, and this blue one is you can't almost see, but it's A domains. And as you see, well, I hope you see that the yellow helix is very long, and starting from this luminal end surface to the very near to the phosphorylation site, to the end of the P domain, I mean. So. And other thing that I would like to stress is that they are sort of linked by a very sort of look like a flexible links, right? But perhaps you can't really see. I'm sorry about this. Okay, so let's go into a bit of detail. And so this is a calcium binding site, and now you are looking from the cytoplasmic side approximately normal to the membrane. So this one, this is cyan spheres representing the calcium ions. And the two calcium ions, as I mentioned, are located side by side. And by looking at this calcium, you perhaps realize that the environment are quite different. The binding mode is different. The site one is made by all side chain atoms, side chain oxygen atoms, like this one, this one, this one, this one, this one, and two water molecules. As I mentioned yesterday, that the calcium likes seven coordinations, and certainly in this case, the coordination is seven. So seven oxygen atoms make binding. And you look at the side two, it's completely different. And the side two are formed by main chain oxygen atoms, like this one, that one, and that one. And the glutamate 309, this one, it has a carboxyl group, so it has two oxygen atoms, sort of capping this one, this calcium bind. Calcium. So the side 2 calcium almost sitting on the end of alpha helix, and this glutamate is sort of capping this calcium. And if you are familiar with the calcium binding protein. That's quite reminiscent of EF hand motif I mentioned yesterday. So it's the most frequent calcium binding motif found in soluble calcium binding proteins. But it's very much the same here. And I also would like to mention that only one amino acid residue is called, it's termed D800, sort of bridging the two calcium ions. And from site mutagenesis studies, we know that this site 1 is a fast calcium ion to bind, and then the second one binds. And that explains the cooperativity of calcium binding pretty well, but because when the calcium gets in, perhaps the site 2 is not properly formed. And so if it's properly formed, it must be trapped here. But if it's not properly formed, so the calcium can get through this site to site 1 calcium, site 1. And then perhaps this D800 positioned properly and allows the second calcium ion to bind with a high affinity. And the reason why this site is a fast calcium ion binding site is explained like this. So if you remove, say, just one oxygen atom from this one or that one, you completely lose the calcium binding ability. But if you remove this one or that one, you still have 50% of calcium binding ability. So the easiest explanation is that this is a fast calcium ion and to bind. So because if the first one cannot bind, the second one cannot bind either. But even you destroy this second one, the first one is still fine, and if you have a 50% calcium affinity. So the next one I should look at is the so-called E1 to E2 equilibrium, or the more rigorously, E1 calcium to E2 equilibrium. So the what it's doing here is you add calcium or some chelating reagent to remove calcium. So this is a sort of equilibrium process, and no sort of energy other than the thermal energy is required. But still, you see such a big, really big movement, and you can consider this as a sort of a shortcut of active transport. So the calcium binding E1 calcium form is a starting conditions, and the E2 state is, you can consider that after the calcium binding. So there are several things clearly occur. One important thing is that this open sort of headpiece closes in the absence of calcium. And also this long helix, this green one, it's called M5 helix, as I mentioned. So it's very long helix sort of bows this direction in the absence of calcium. And the third thing I should mention is that this movement, right? This cyan helix is M4 helix. As I showed in this previous slide, that M4 helix forms a very important part of a calcium binding site. It uses a main chain oxygen atoms. So if it really moves, then perhaps this calcium also moves. But what we see here is that this M4 helix moves like this. And so I have to sort of introduce the numbering of the helices, because otherwise you can't refer to the structure well. So this, the left-hand side is the one is the sort of more simplified representations. I use a cylinder instead of ribbons or spirals to represent the alpha helices. So what we see here is that this M4 helix, M4L, It's moved like this. And it is easier to see the movement perhaps from the side. So M4 helix is here, like this. So, right, the calcium is located there in the calcium bound form and must be released like this. So what we see here is a kind of piston-like movement. So it's like they're really like a mechanical pumps. And but and I mentioned two things and big differences in the E1 to E2 movement. And so M5 bent largely towards M1. M1 is one located here. So it's bent like this, right? Yeah, you see this part. M5 sort of bends like this. And M3 and M4 move together to the luminal side by one turnover alpha helix. And I did not mention this one, but M6 rotates by 90 degrees or so. And by doing this, what we see here is the number of oxygen atoms that possibly contribute to make a calcium binding site. In the calcium bound form, 5 oxygen atoms from amino acid side chains and 2 water molecules form site 1. And in the site 2, 4 side chain oxygen atoms and 3 main chain oxygen atoms to form site 2. As I mentioned in mutagenesis experiment, removing only one of this side chain oxygen atoms will completely destroy the calcium binding ability. And in this configuration, it certainly has only 4 calcium, the oxygen atom can make this site. And if the number of water molecules is the same. And that applies to site 2 also. And so that nicely explains the low affinity of this state. And so the mechanism is here. So as I mentioned, we need a sort of a catch state, occlude state, and release state. And by this one is correspond to E1 2 calcium form, and this one correspond to the E2 form. And very old, old Townford model is like something like this. So it perhaps requires a very small change of calcium coordination. When it catches the calcium, some charged residues will be arranged so that it makes a very nice coordination of calcium. And when it's released, perhaps it needs to require just a small change. So maybe this helix twisted or inclined so that some the coordination geometry become poor and decrease the affinity. And it's not really the case. And this is my model I thought initially. And because the part of the helix actually broken, it may be possible to sort of extend this part. And then the calcium coordination will be worse and will be released. But what we found is not like this. It moves like that, right? Like a mechanical pumps. And so let's see how it's made. And the three things I mentioned, how they are related. And so the key thing is, one of the key things is this M5 helix. It's a very long one, and sort of bends like that. It is sort of integrated into the P-domain. We are now looking at the P-domain here. So the phosphorylation residues, aspartate 351, is located here. This M5 helix, very long transmembrane helix, has N-terminal end here. So, and also M4 helix. That's a helix. It really makes the site 2, calcium binding site. It's sort of connected to M5 helix by forming this kind of sheet structures. So something happens here will be sort of transmitted to these transmembrane helices easily. And also, something happened somewhere there, will be transmitted to the phosphorylation site also. So it's a mechanical links. And this one compares the two states, and calcium bound form is always violet, and the E2 form is always green, like this. By superimposing these two structures, we see that M5 sort of bends like that, and M4 moves together, and then the M4 sort of kicks the M2 helix in the E1 state. So it's a violet one. So the M2 helix cannot stay there. So that has to move like this. And that also moves M1 helix. So it's a kind of a molecular dominance takes place here. So it's a very large global conformation change. But the important thing is that what you really need is changing the curvature of this M5 helix. And also it is possible to explain the downward movement of M4 helix by very simple geometric causing and considerations. So and M4 and M5 helix are sort of integrated in the P domain. So if the M5 helix moves from this position to that position, then the P domain inclines. That pushes the M4 helix. This is actually the mechanism it really used. And I hope you remember that the inclination of the P domain will move the M4 helix downward. That is the key movement there is. So the next thing is one of the main events, the ATP binding. And you see of course this is something wrong here because this N domain starts to move to just catch the ATP here. Well, that perhaps not in the real case, the ATP binds much far earlier in the steps. But, that's a sort of an artifact of the interpolation, anyway. Okay, and what I want to stress is that the three things. And here, the open headpiece becomes compact again, right? And the second thing is that this blue one, M1 helix, is sort of pulled upwards by ATP binding, and this part, the top part, sort of bends like that. And it is easier to see this movement from side, right? So the binding of ATP, this blue ones, M1, so-called M1, the M2 helix, sort of brought up into the cytoplasm and formed a kind of a V-shaped structures. And this part, called M1 dash, M1 prime, becomes a very short helix. It sort of lies on the top of the membrane surface, and it's clearly facilitated by the A domain movement. And if you look at the A domain like this, it's the A2 helix sort of rotates like that. So the A domain is actually tilts by the ATP binding like this. And I think one more thing I should stress, that the movement of this link. So by tilting of this A domain, it pulls these things, M1, M2, and M3 links. So these flexible links are all pulled up and perhaps strained. So you know that in the chemical reaction, putting strain and causes the reaction to go through fast. And so this is very similar sort of maneuver is used for making the reaction forward here. Okay, I did not mention that just the binding of calcium does not close the cytoplasmic gate. And this Cy2 calcium is actually exchangeable with calcium ions in the cytoplasm. These spheres represent the water molecules bound in the crystal. So it means that the water can reach this part. And also, That means the calcium perhaps be able to come this point. So this is a sort of a wider view of this area. And you see the two calcium ions here. And you see these red spheres represent the water molecules around this binding site. So this one is the glutamate that's capping this calcium. So there is plenty of space for this glutamate ions, sorry, the glutamate side chain to change its conformation. So it may change the conformation this way to that way, then this calcium may be able to get out from here to there, and the new one comes in. So it means that the cytoplasmic gate is not really closed in this state. But here, we see in this state, this space is occupied by a large side chain of hydrophobic residues. Here you find leucines and leucines. And there is no space for this glutamate side chain to change its conformation. And to do that, the enzyme actually moves the whole helix here, not just the one residue. The ATPase moves whole helix. That's the one we saw in the previous movies. So it's now clear that calcium cannot get out. So this must be the mechanism of occlusion. So the gate mechanism of the gate closure of the cytoplasmic gate. And this movement is certainly facilitated by binding of ATP, because we used a non-hydrolyzable analog of ATP, so-called AMPPCPs. And so this usually oxygen must be here, but in this one, the carbon atom here. And it's located near the hinge between the N domain and the P domain, and sort of cross-links these two domains. So this is a sort of more detailed view. The point here is that ATP binds to the adenine ring binds to this green one, so the N domain, and the phosphate region binds the P domain. So it's a cross-link, really. So if the ATP gamma phosphate is transferred, so this bond is cleaved, then there's perhaps no need for the enzyme to keep this conformation. And so it will be released, and the enzyme will be released. So in a way, this ATP analog, so cross-links the P and the N domains so that the phosphorylated transfer can be able to take place. And also important is this magnesium ion, metal ions here. And why important is shown here. And this, again, it's a bit difficult picture, busy picture, and because the P domain of the two states are superimposed. And the E1 calcium form is shown always in violet. So this yellow one is the PMPPCP form. And what we see here is that the binding of nucleotide and magnesium sort of bends the domains. And you see the orientation of this M4 as a P6 helix and P7 helix. It's bent like that. And what is important is A domain and P domain interacts only this point. So it's A domain, one of the end of the A domain is sitting almost on this helix. So it changes a bit, only slightly, maybe 20 degrees or so. But because this change occurs near the sort of pivoting point, and there's some change somewhere here must be very large. And that's really the case. And so in the previous movie, I showed that by binding of ADP, the A domain rotates like that. But the change here is very small, just 20 degrees or so bending of the P domain. That brings the A domain so much. The angle is 20 degrees or something like that, but the movement is very large. That's large enough for bringing up this M2 and M5 helices like this. Right? Okay, so the next step is a real main event, the calcium release. And what happens here is 110 degrees or so rotation of the A domain. This time, it's horizontal rotations. You see here, the A2 helix move like that, right? And what happens is that the rotation is transmitted to this V-shaped structure formed by M1, M2 helices. And that this M1 helix sort of pushes this M4 helix like that. So as I mentioned, that key movement is the downward movement of M4 and M3 helices like this, that we saw in the E1 calcium to E2 equilibriums. So what happened here is that the A domain rotates, it moves this V-shaped structure, and that moves this M4 and M3 helices. And how it is done. So this is just a top view of this rotation. So the start point here, E1 P state. So you look at this cylinder representing A2 helix. It's the original position is here. And after sort of E2, it become E2 P state, it comes this position. So very large rotations. And one more thing I should mention, that in this state, so the both gates are closed, and this state, cytoplasmic gate is closed, but luminal gate is opened, and this state and both gates are sort of closed again. So I mentioned this one. The luminal gate is closed in this E1P analog, and this one is beryllium fluoride, E2P ground state analogs. And this one, aluminum fluoride, and it's a transition state analog. I'll show you some detail in a few minutes later. So by rotating this one, 0 degree to 90 degrees, what we see here is that this V-shaped structure sort of moves from this position to that position, and pushes this M4 helix, M3 and M4 helix like that. And that causes the opening of a luminal gate. And how this movement and this movement is related is an important question. And let's think about this kind of movement. And also, if what is important is actually the shape of this P domain. P domain, you see it's a wedge-like shape, has a wedge-like shape, right? And the A domain sort of moving over on the top surface of this wedge. So what happens is in the E1P positions, the A domain is here. And in the E2P form, it comes like this. So if the P domain is fixed, and M domain, M1 helix, for example, is movable, then by moving this, it simply lifts the transmembrane helices, right? But if this transmembrane helices want to stay in the membrane, and P domain can sort of change its inclination. What happens is that the P domain comes this position, keeping this M1 helix at the same position, right? And what I mentioned is in the E2 equilibrium, the P domain sort of inclines and pushes M4 downwards. That's a sort of key event. And here, and certainly we see that kind of movement, and the fact sort of causes such downward movement is that this M1 helix want to stay in the main transmembrane regions. Maybe I go back to this movie to see you again. Yeah, here you see these things. Green ones are P domains. You see the it's inclined to move towards the membrane when the A domain moves in to these directions, right? So this is a sort of a mechanism that opening of the luminal gate. Yeah, so A domain rotates, it moves this V-shaped structure also, and at the same time, because this A domain rotates like this, and M1 or M2 helices stays in the membrane, so it inclines the P domain, and that causes this M4 helix downwards and pushes down the M4 helix. And that's the mechanism of luminal gating. If you look at from the side, that really happens because the A domain rotates this way to this one. And at the same time, P domain sort of inclines because M1 or M2 helices stay there. And the M5 helix certainly allows that kind of inclination. So that's such, so that the, how that's this M5 helix sort of designed. So this is a sort of just an open state. So this is our occluded state. You cannot have space to water or calcium to get in. But here you see a relatively large opening and certain calcium can get released through this gate. Okay, the second step from just as from here to there. Okay, what happens here? Yeah, you now compare this to beryllium fluoride structure to aluminium fluoride structures. What you see here is M2 helix unwinding. And M2 helix is a sort of continuous helix in this state, but here it's broken. So it into two pieces, right? Because a helix is a sort of very winding wound structure, so it needs many residue to span certain distance. But if you extend like this, it easily allows 5 angstrom or so downward movement. That actually happened here, and so you see that M1 position of this end of the bridge-shaped structure changes from this position to that position. And that causes a sort of downward movement, M1 helix, from this position to that position. So it presses this M4 helix to close the luminal gate. So the mechanism here is that the M2 helix has a switch, and the helix to coil transition here occurs here. And that sort of allows this V-shaped structure to go downward and close the gate. And at the same time, this rotation sort of one does one more thing, or two more things actually. By doing this very large rotation, what we now see is that what happens in the phosphorations, around the phosphorylation site. And this is a sort of magnified view of this area. By 110 degree rotations, and the one loop, so-called TGES loop, I write them here, comes into this position and occupies where the ADP was. So it's clearly preventing the rebinding of ADP. And so for the ADP to be able to rebind, whole structure has to be moved. So that must be a quite big movement. So the backward reaction here is sort of prevented by physically bringing in the important, bringing in and prevents the backward reaction. That seems to be the way this enzyme really works. There are two ways for enzyme to sort of facilitate the catalysis. One way is to, of course, accelerate the forward reaction. The other possibility is to prevent the backward reaction. And here we see several places that mechanism for preventing backward reactions. And anyway, by going from this position to that position, also we see a kind of electrostatic catch. And this in the P domain and the A domain forms interface in this region. And we see a charged residues, arginine, and on the other side it's aspartate. And the other place is also arginine, and here use the main chain atom. But we see a sort of a staggered electrostatic catch. So electrostatic things are long range interactions. So maybe able to catch the A domain moving in this direction and just stabilize there. So many things actually occur here. And this movement must be related to hydrolysis of aspartate phosphate. So what I wanted to show is that aspartate, where it is? Yeah, here. This is aspartate 351 and forms a sort of a triangular things pointing downwards here, because this is a covalent bound form, and so the phosphate is the fourth one of the fourth atom, oxygen atom of phosphate is here, right? And it has a magnesium here, and this is a sort of ground state. In the transition state, the movement must be very small, because that's just an inversion of this triangular things. And in the this transition state analog, it's a planar things. You see here, it's a planar phosphate analogs. So this is the transition state, and certainly we now see these water molecules in the perfect position to attack this aluminium. Transition state analogs. And we also see a glutamate here. So it's glutamate can work as a general base or acid and activate this water molecule. And in this state, this glutamate is pointing sort of inward of this loop, and cannot make this kind of interactions. And so the things moves in here is very small, but we now see a water molecule comes in here. And that force sort of causes the change of movement. This is called the change of this loop. It's a TGES loop. And TGES loop is one of the signature sequence of P-type ATPases. It's very important for hydrolysis of aspartate phosphate. And so the reason why is here, the glutamate 183 sort of activates water molecules and also sort of stabilizes state in these conformations. So this is just a space fill model. And in the DP ground state, it's completely occupied by protein and magnesium. And in this case, it's barium fluoride here. So no space for the water to get in to make hydrolysis. Now in the phosphorylation, so the transition state, we see this water molecule can attack this transition state analog of phosphate just enough for just one water molecule here. So this is a small change, but it's really functionally very meaning, has a big meaning. And now I show you a kind of animations. I hope you see it now a bit better. So this is a ground state is E to P, and the tilde or squiggle means transition state, and dot PI stands for the product state. And what is important is in the ground state, the triangular things point downwards, and transition state become planar, and then the production state, it squats like this. So we now see a chemical reaction of aspartate phosphate in sort of atomic details. And so the movement of water molecule changes this, moves the TGS group, that causes hydrolysis and also causes the movement of A domain further, and sort of correlates the hydrolysis by aspartate to gating things. So this is E2P to E2 transition. So you see the gate is closed by release of phosphate. So the summary is kind of like this. So the A domain is the actuator of the transmembrane gate. Its position and orientation are regulated by domain interface, and it's really the gate, gating sort of mechanism. And ATP phosphate, magnesium, and calcium are sort of main modifiers of the interface. But it doesn't tell you why such large and complicated movements are necessary. And what does ATP do? It's relatively easy to understand. And ATP is a kind of cleavable crosslinker that bridges the N and P domain. It tilts the A domain and places a strain on the A domain M3 link. That I maybe forgot to mention that this is really the driving force of the A domain rotation, because if you cut this link via proteolysis, no rotation or no ATP hydrolysis takes place. But this seems to need only the structure of ATP. And where the ATP, the energy of ATP hydrolysis goes. That's a quite interesting and important question I give you as a sort of a subject to think about. And the reason why such a large and complicated movements are necessary is here. So the answer is perhaps ion pumps fracture so much by thermal energy, yet you have to utilize it effectively for transporting ions. To explain this to you, I show you molecular dynamic simulations. And this is a real system. So the one calcium ATPS molecule put in the explicit lipid bilayers and water molecules and salt. And this one is 150 millimolar potassium chloride. And the blue ones is potassium, and the red ones is perhaps chloride. But you see, even at 150 millimolar, the number of ions is fairly small. So if it's a 10 millimolar or even micromolar calcium, the chances for getting this enzyme must be very small. But still, it functions, right? And the computation power we have is something like this. And because this is a huge system, although I have a quite good ones, and I can make a 5 parallel computation, but I can simulate 0.4 nanosecond per day. Well, but do you remember from yesterday's talk that the calcium ATPS needs 30 milliseconds to go through one cycle? So if you divide by that number, by this one. You can't sort of imagine that the calculation will be done within your lifetime. But still, it gives you a very good insight on how it really works. So this is a 30 nanosecond simulation. And this tiny violet spheres represent the calcium. So you see so much movement here. Right? Also, this domain fluctuates so much. And in the next one, I show you a magnified view of that area, calcium binding region. So you see it's very shaking so much. And this red, small red spheres represent water molecules. And that sort of attack this side 2 calcium continuously. And only this glutamate side chain sort of prevent the water molecule to really attack this calcium. So we, as I mentioned, if this is not, in this state, the cytoplasmic gate is not really closed. So if it's this glutamate side chain change its conformation open, allows access of water molecules to this one, perhaps whole system allows this one, this calcium to pop out and new one to come in. So it's quite perhaps easy to understand. So even though the simulation is limited, you can get a quite good insight how it really works. So this is a sort of you are taking home message. And ion pumps work in the thermal, English is wrong, but never mind. And the pumps work in the thermal fluctuating world, yet they utilize thermal energy effectively for pumping, transporting ions. And to do that, I think it's quite important to mention that they use flexible links between the A-domain and these transmembrane helices and press the strain for driving the movement to one direction. So if it's a flexible link, perhaps you cannot press it so that the reactions go back to the previous position, to the previous state. So putting strain and on the flexible link seems to be the way to prevent a backward reaction also. And also perhaps the cooperative binding of the nucleotide and magnesium also prevent the backward reactions. And so for the important part, it uses helix-helix contact. But for driving to one direction, seems to use strains on flexible links. So the nature uses the same sort of maneuver to make the reaction proceed. And in the simple chemical reactions, if it's the molecule is distorted and strained, then the chances for this molecule to break down is much higher. So it's similar thing is used for different purposes. But in a way, I think it's the principle is the same. Okay, so I think I'd like to thank you for your attention and stop here.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.